I'm John Kroll. On today's No Limits, we're going to talk about the life and legacy of Hoosier journalist John Bartlow Martin. Now almost forgotten, John Bartlow Martin was one of the 20th century's most successful freelance writers. He also was a speechwriter and close advisor to Democratic presidents and presidential candidates for more than 20 years, and he served as an ambassador. Martin is the subject of a new biography by historian Ray Boomhauer. We're going to talk with Boomhauer about this Hoosier writer who was once one of the most prominent journalists in the country. This is a pre-recorded show, so we won't be taking calls, emails, or messages via social media. But we hope you enjoy the conversation.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about the life and legacy of John Bartlow Martin. The Springboard is a really fine new biography of Martin written by historian Ray Boomhauer. Ray, welcome to the program.
John, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
It's good to have you here, and I should inform our audience that this is a recorded program, so we're not going to be taking calls. We won't be getting emails. Well, we'll still get them. We just won't be able to respond to them immediately. Tweets or Facebook messages. So I want to start a little bit. We probably ought to, you know, the thumbnail here of Martin's life is the freelance writer, and that was sort of the theme that ran through everything that he did. But it was a much more multivariate career than that. Ray, could you kind of walk us through what this guy's significance was, and then I want to talk with you about the path that led you to wanting to tell his story.
Sure, I'd be glad to, John. When you say the name John Bartlow Martin today, not many people realize who he was or what kind of influence he had on the history of American politics, culture, and writing in the 20th century. But if I mention some of the names he was involved with, you realize what kind of importance he did have. Adlai Stevenson, John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Jimmy Hoffa, Hubert Humphrey, Lyndon Johnson, George McGovern, and the list goes on and on. And he, of course, started out life as he once said, you know, hell, I'm just a reporter. But he was much more than that. He was involved in every Democratic presidential campaign from Adlai Stevenson in 1952 all the way up to George McGovern's ill-fated run in 1972 as a speechwriter and inside advisor, was really considered one of the best reporters in America during the height of the Big Slick magazines of the 1940s and the 1950s, and really became the go-to nonfiction narrative fact writer for the Saturday Evening Post when the Post was the leading magazine in every American home. And so he was well-known. His articles were well-received, and his name was known by reporters and political people all across the country.
Well, and he was, in addition to all of that, he also was the ambassador to the Dominican Republic for a while. You know, it's like
there are
three different kinds of careers going on at any given time. And the hook here, obviously, is that he was from Indiana. I mean, I know he was born elsewhere, but his time in Hamilton, Ohio was very brief.
That's right. I like to tell people there are three places that form John Bartlow Martin's character and the person he became. And the first one was here in Indianapolis. Later on, it was Chicago during the height of his freelance days. And his retreat for his soul in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. But it all started here in Indianapolis. And as he said in his memoirs, you know, most people who write their memoirs had happy childhoods. John Bartlow Martin certainly did not have a happy childhood here in Indianapolis. His parents had a troubled marriage. Two of his brothers died in infancy, one after catching a scarlet fever from his brother John and dying from it. So who knows the guilt that could bring on a person. Mm-hmm. And Martin remembers the you know, very tragic days of the Great Depression, his father losing his business, having to hit the streets to find a job, not having food on the table, being afraid that they'd be losing their house. And so his days in Indianapolis were dark ones.
And we should establish it, you've sort of nailed down the fact that he did not come from a background of wealth or even comfort. I mean, there was a lot of financial insecurity. His parents, as you say, divorced and then remarried
later on.
But there was a, you know, real kind of instability. And I think there was at least one of his parents married someone else
in between the
two. What, you know, when did he start the journey toward becoming? Because it's kind of career now. I can't even think of a modern day parallel to what he's doing, in part because the freelance market of that sort has dried up, and the idea of writers as kind of journalistic rock stars has been displaced by, you know, electronic media and all of that sort of stuff. But he was a really big deal. I mean, you know, magazines would covet his stuff.
And pay top dollar for it.
I mean, he lived a life of comfort, of some comfort with, you know, the proceeds from his pen, which is not an easy thing to do. Any of us who have written for a living sort of sympathize with I think the famous line from Elmore Leonard's book, Get Shorty, that's a joke. One of the characters says, what kind of writing pays best? And then he answers the question himself, ransom notes.
That's right.
You know, it's a joke only writers really appreciate. So, you know, what started him on the path to doing this? And it's kind of an unlikely climb.
His really path started here in Indianapolis at Arsenal Technical High School, which when you think of it, you wouldn't think they'd be strong in humanities. But he had very good teachers, especially in English, that inspired his imagination when he was a young man. Got to write for the newspaper, the kind of yearbook literary magazine they had at Arsenal Technical. And he knew from a young age that he wanted to be a writer. He was inspired by those great writers of the 20s like Theodore Dreiser, John Dos Passos, Ernest Hemingway. And so it's a path that he wanted to follow, even though his father did not want it for him, derisively called him the bookworm growing up. And yet, for Christmas presents, would buy him the books that he wanted. So there's that contradiction in their relationship.
Giveth, taketh away.
That's right. Yeah. He wanted him, you know, to follow in his footsteps. His father was a contractor for a time, had a very prosperous business before the Great Depression ruined it, and wanted him to become an engineer. But John had no interest in that kind of career, wanted to be a writer, and always looked to Chicago. You know, Chicago was kind of the place to go if you were from, you know, a smaller town, even, you know, or even a larger city like Indianapolis. It drew people to it who wanted to live that kind of life. And unfortunately for Martin, he had a disastrous first marriage, married too young, from a girl he met at DePauw University.
Well, and he had kind of a strange start at DePauw, too, where he's
that's right.
He technically did flunk out at one point.
I think he failed German, and they kicked him out.
Not because he failed
drinking,
German.
Though, for carousing a bit too much, for acting up. And it was during the height of the Great Depression. He and his father walked the streets looking for a job. And fortunately for him, he, thanks to a family friend, he got a job as a stock gummer with the Associated Press office in Indianapolis, taking stock quotations and gumming them on a sheet of paper. And then that grew into a more writing career. He wrote for, you know, covered some things for the AP, and I think he really loved that job. But they wouldn't hire him without a college degree. They urged him to go back to college. He went back to DePauw, worked on the student newspaper there, was editor of the newspaper, a stringer for the Indianapolis Times newspaper. And even before graduating, they offered him a job, so he completed his coursework at DePauw in absentia and started working for the Indianapolis Times.
And then from there, though relatively early, he got his fill of newspaper work.
He decided that, you know, you couldn't really spend 8 hours a day doing journalism works and hoped to do any other kind of writing, which he wanted to do. He was encouraged by his editors at the Indianapolis Times that he should be writing magazine stories. But there really wasn't any time after such a long day of covering the news, as a lot of journalists realize, a lot of those who work on daily newspapers, as I once did. There's not a lot of time left in the day after you get off the job. And so he left because his wife's mother died, and they went to live with her father. But that marriage broke up. He was at loose ends, and he decided to go to Chicago and start his writing career. He had met with an editor named Harry Keller, who had two fact detective magazines that he did, official detective stories and actual detective stories of women in crime. And those two publications were a lifeline for Martin, the 2 cents a word market, as it was. And that's where he cut his teeth as a freelance reporter in Chicago.
If you are just joining us, this is a special edition of No Limits, a recorded version of the show, which means we're not taking calls or messages via email or social media. We're talking with biographer Ray Boomauer about his new book on John Bartlow Martin, who was one of the leading freelance writers and sort of man of letters of the 20th century, a Hoosier, who also served as diplomat to or ambassador to the Dominican Republic and was a speechwriter and confidant for pretty much every leading Democratic president or national politician for a period of 20 years. Mm-hmm. So we've got him now. He's started writing for these really somewhat lowbrow detective magazines, and he's making a fair amount of money doing that. I mean, he's gotten to the point, and you know, to read your book, I mean, among other things, I'm just stunned at how prolific he was. I mean, and this is in the days before there was anything even vaguely resembling a word processor. The fact that he had to type and retype and all of that adds to the impressiveness. How did he make the leap then to more serious sort of creative nonfiction or reporting?
Well, during his time when he was writing for the Fact Detective magazines, as he said, when he hit his stride, he was writing a million words a year at one point, which when you think about it is astounding.
Staggering.
Including writing a love advice column for, and this is despite being divorced
under an assumed name.
Man. Yeah, it's kind of unusual, but he did anything to pay the bills at that time. I think what really changed for him and got him on a different track was the influence of his second wife, Fran Martin, who he met in Chicago and married. She really, I think, stabilized him and put him on the path where he had the confidence to go ahead and try to submit his stuff to more highbrow magazines. And he really got a break by getting his articles in Harper's Magazine, which at that time did not pay a lot, mm-hmm. but was one of those magazines that was influential in the intellectual circles of the time.
In some ways, it's still the case.
Still the case today, exactly. And he broke through, developed a very close relationship with the editor there, Frederick Lewis Allen, who wrote some of the better books about the 1920s.
Since yesterday,
exactly. Yeah. And thanks to that connection, particularly after the war, with his article on the Centralia mine disaster, that really set his reputation, got the attention of editors of other magazines, and set him on the course to become one of the better freelance writers and more highly paid freelance writers in the country.
Real quickly, because we're getting a little tight on time, that probably ought to explain to listeners what the Centralia mine disaster was.
There was a coal mine in outside of Centralia, Illinois, and there was coal dust that had accumulated. And the miners knew the conditions were unsafe, had even written a letter to the governor asking them to help save their lives. And it was a story of bureaucratic incompetence that led to the death eventually of 111 miners. And Martin went to Centralia to report on the story, what happened, followed the story all the way through. And when it was published in Harper's in 1948, it made his reputation.
And at that point, really, he began to leave the detective magazines and all of that.
Yeah, he started to leave that behind. Yeah. He is still dependent upon it to make enough money to live on, but that really set him on the stage to work for the Big Slick magazine.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with historian Ray Boomhauer about his new biography of John Bartlow Martin, 20th century Hoosier reporter, diplomat, political advisor, sort of all-around man of letters. This is a recorded show, so we're not taking calls, emails, Facebook messages, or tweets. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about the life and career of John Bartlow Martin, a Hoosier who was at one time one of the most renowned men of letters in the nation, perhaps in some ways the world. He is the subject of a brand new biography by historian Ray Boomhauer, and we're talking with Ray today. This is a recorded show, so we're not taking calls, emails, Facebook messages, or tweets. And before we went to the break, we talked about how Martin made the leap from working in detective magazines, sort of lowbrow publications, to Harper's, a publication that was much more highbrow, but did not pay all particularly well. There was a time, though, when he may have been the most highly paid print journalist in the country, or at least one of them.
Receiving $5,000, which was a lot of money back then for one series
before
the Saturday Post.
That's still not a small freelance fee.
Right.
So let's talk about the transition of how he went from Harper's to that, and then we got to get into his. You know, a role that became much more familiar in the 80s and 90s of journalists sort of hopping back and forth from reporting the news to making it as being part of political campaigns. He sort of anticipated that development, too.
He did quite a bit as a speechwriter.
Yeah. So let's talk first, though, about how he exploded into becoming perhaps the most highly paid journalist or print journalist in the country at the time.
Well, that Centralia article that he had in Harper's in March 1948 really put his name on the map as far as editors of the larger circulation magazines of the time, the Big Slick magazines, particularly the Saturday Evening Post, that were very popular at that time period. He was also able, because of that article, hook up with the Harold Ober agency. So he had an agent, Harold Ober, who was very well known in the magazine in Brookfield at that time, and was able to negotiate, money and contracts for Martin to do work, and really helped him out because he didn't have to worry about that aspect of his career anymore. And Harold Ober was very important to Martin in his career. And he really became the fact writer for the Saturday Evening Post, the one that they turned to when they wanted to do major stories about major issues of the day in the 1950s. And if you think of the Saturday Evening Post today, you think of a very conservative publication that had a rosy outlook on life in the 1950s, particularly with the covers that they had with Norman Rockwell's Celebration of Americana and American Life. But for the time, after relying a lot on fiction, they turned more and more to nonfiction in the 1950s, and they had very hard-hitting subjects that they covered in their pages. And most of these were written by Martin. They were multi-part series and very serious subjects, including abortion, which at that time you couldn't even use the term abortion often. It was known as illegal surgery, desegregation in the South, crime, marriages falling apart, all kinds of major issues you think the Saturday Evening Post wouldn't tackle. They did tackle because Martin did it for them. He went out, did thorough investigations and reporting on these subjects, and produce multi-part series that were, as one person called Martin, fact-obsessed. You knew you would get straight-ahead, no-biased reporting from Martin when he covered a particular subject or issue.
And that's, in reading his work, and it's been a few years since I have, my introduction to reading Martin's work actually was reading his massive two-volume biography of Adlai Stevenson. We're going to move into the political career here in a second. But I do recall reading that at the time and thinking, oh, my goodness, he didn't leave anything in the notebook here.
No, he put everything on the page. He wanted to, when you were done with that, you know anything about Adlai Stevenson you ever want to know.
Yes, and I guess, you know, one of the things that keeps coming back, you refer to it in the book, is that, you know, it's not like he really made the prose sing or anything like that. It was just, these were the most thoroughly documented and reported pieces of work that you could imagine.
That's right. He was a serious man. He liked to write about serious subjects. As he once said, I think it's one of my favorite quotes of Martin, I've always been interested in the individual human being and what happens to him in a society that really doesn't work as well as it should. It sounds kind of pretentious, but I think it's so. And that's really the quote that you could use for all of his writings at that time period.
Well, and the subtitle for your book is A Voice for the Underdog. You know, where did that come from? I mean, obviously he'd become, by the 1950s, when he's, still in his 30s, he's no longer really an underdog. I mean, he's a prosperous man. He's well-connected politically. I mean, there are very few doors that are closed to him anymore.
I think he never forgot what he had experienced here in Indianapolis, what the Great Depression did to his family, what Franklin Roosevelt's administration did to save them and save American society at that time from, you know, going under, and always felt a sympathy for the underdog. He said, you know, he made his living not interviewing the great, but interviewing what the Spaniards call los de abajo, those from below, the underdogs in society. And he always liked doing that, and that's what he did in his reporting, and especially for his multi-part series for the Post during all those years in the 1950s and early 60s.
And let's talk a little bit about how he you know, in our business, they talk about jumping the fence. When you, you know, when you begin working, rather than covering politicians, you begin working for them. What drew him into Adlai Stevenson's orbit?
It was going to be another book project for him. He had written a couple before. He wrote A Regional History of the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. He wrote what's still one of the best books on Indiana called Indiana, An Interpretation.
Yeah, that and Irving Leibowitz's book are the two best,
yes,
I think.
And Jim Madison's new one.
Yeah, Jim Madison's.
The New History of Indiana is right up there as well if you want a contemporary view of Indiana. But Martin had been called in by a friend of his, an attorney, to meet Adlai Stevenson, who at that time was governor of Illinois. He had made a very good reform-minded effort for the state, which is known more a lot in politics for its corruption. Uh-huh. And he'd kind of turned things around. And on the thought that Martin could help Stevenson put together a collection of his speeches. But Stevenson didn't want to do that. He thought it'd be much better to do a book on how state government worked, and Martin would be a good person to write about that since he had also written about the rise of Mayor Daley in Chicago, so he knew politics in Illinois. While all that was going on, Martin did some reporting about Stevenson and decided to do more of a straight biography to introduce him to people, because the word was out that Stevenson might be the Democratic presidential candidate in 1952. The convention that year for the Democrats was in Chicago, and Stevenson was basically drafted to be the nominee for the Democrats.
Yeah, Truman decided not to run again.
And Stevenson was the man that they selected. So he had his headquarters in Springfield, and Martin had been asked by the Stevenson campaign to come down and help out with publicity, with media relations. When he got there, he realized that he didn't much like the political reporters, thought they weren't being serious about it. They were complaining too much. And he drifted more and more to the speechwriting group, which was headquartered in the Elks Club in Springfield and included such heavy hitters for the Democrats at that time as Arthur Schlesinger Jr., the Harvard historian, John Kenneth Galbraith. And Martin was very impressed by these gentlemen, realized they were doing a serious job, and he wanted to be part of that, and so drifted over into the speech writing group, which was kind of odd because there was the belief at that time that, you know, Stevenson was such a good orator that he wrote all his speeches himself. And that's the kind of myth that developed. But behind the scenes, there was this very impressive group of speechwriters who were writing for him, and Martin fell into that group. And that's how he got started.
It's hard to recapture, I think, probably these days, the kind of allure that Adlai Stevenson seemed to have, because you're right. I mean, you're talking about some of the, you know, heaviest intellectual hitters of the mid 20th century. All were working for Stevenson at that point for basically peanuts. I mean, Martin took a major pay cut. Mm-hmm. To do this. What was it about Stevenson that made him want to surrender sort of his journalistic autonomy?
I think he was impressed by Stevenson's intellectual ability, the fact that he was a reform-minded individual as well, someone who would further democratic goals in that era. And there was just something about the man that drew a lot of these heavy hitters of the Democratic Party, as you've said, to his side. But he wasn't a perfect man by any means, was often seen as indecisive, liked politics, but was unsure if he was up to the task from time to time. Liked being governor, liked the power, but wasn't sure if he could be trusted with that power as president, perhaps, and just, you know, always seen as indecisive, but someone who really
referred to him as the Hamlet of Springfield.
That's right. Even in his speech at the convention, saying, you know, let this cup pass from me, but if I can't, you know, he's quoting the Bible and not being worthy up to the task, even in his acceptance speech at the Democratic convention. So there's that aspect of him, but he was a very witty man. Mm-hmm. Very well-read, and he captured what was later called, of course, the eggheads of American society at that time, which was then something that was used to belittle intellectuals.
Well, that's not exactly a compliment today.
No, that's true.
So how much of it, though, was Martin's involvement with Stevenson a product of his wife's influence? Because you notice that, you mentioned several times in the book that Fran was on the board of directors of the state affiliate of the American Civil Liberties Union, which suggests, particularly in that era, an appetite or an interest for progressive or liberal politics.
It was really a family affair. The whole Martin family at that time, which included Fran and their young daughter Cindy, were all involved in the Stevenson campaign. Fran was very involved with it. Cindy, even as a young girl, was helping out with the volunteers for Stevenson. So it was, I think, kind of easier for Martin when you had the whole family involved as well as yourself, because he was away from home for quite long periods of time on the campaign trail. And it was later when he was involved in the 1956 campaign with Stevenson, when he ran again against the incumbent Dwight Eisenhower, that he found a real niche for himself, something that he invented. He called it being an editorial advance man. And he kind of developed this in the California primary when Stevenson was running against Estes Kefauver. And would go out ahead of the Stevenson campaign, go to a town ahead of time, really did what he did as a reporter, talk to people, the average man on the street, local politicians, policemen, reporters, and get inside information about a community and give these kind of talking points to the candidate ahead of time. So he would pepper his speech with local observations, know who to thank in the crowd, and really was a great time saver for a candidate if you're on the road giving speech after speech, day after day, to have this kind of advance work already done, where you're kind of melding speech writing and scheduling together. Which Martin had always wanted to do.
So in some ways, he also anticipated the development of the modern advance teams for...
That's right.
For political campaigns as well. If you're just joining us, this is a special recorded No Limits. which we're talking with historian Ray Boomhauer about his new book about John Bartlow Martin. Because it's recorded, we're not taking calls, we're not taking emails, we're not taking Facebook messages or tweets, but we do hope you're enjoying the conversation. How difficult did Martin find it switching back and forth? I mean, there wasn't a whole lot of precedent. Obviously, in the 80s and 90s, journalists hopped the fence all the time, and it became much more sort of an accepted practice. Back then, though, that fence seemed to be a lot higher. It was more difficult. Did he have difficulty getting back to being taken seriously as a journalist?
Not really. It doesn't come across that way. Perhaps because he wasn't tied down to one specific newspaper. He didn't work for a newspaper. He was a freelancer. And the Post was very good about letting him do this. They knew that when he returned, that he would offer non-biased reporting on subjects that they would agree for him to write about. So he was able to go back and forth pretty easily, and there was no big angst. I never ran across any big angst. It didn't bother him, this back and forth between being a freelance journalist and working for these political figures in the Democratic Party.
Was he a reflective man? I mean, in the sense that, you know, he would think about stuff like that or think about where his life, and in reading your book, I mean, I get a sense of a guy who's intensely absorbed in the world around him, but there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of inner contemplation.
I don't think there is while all this is going on. I don't think it was till later when he sat down and decided to write his memoirs. It seems like only yesterday, which is, I think, one of the better things he ever wrote, that he let himself become reflective and realized what had happened and the path he had taken. But at that time, I don't think he was one of those guys who agonized about over every detail. He didn't. He was much more concerned about what comes next.
And how did, obviously he worked with Stevenson again on the 56 campaign. Stevenson was still a player and at some level was sort of half-heartedly angling for a third nomination in 1960. The Democratic Party was sort of divided at that point between Kennedy people, to some degree Johnson people, and then Stevenson. The Stevenson folks had a real hard time letting go, and the Kennedy folks, frankly, weren't that forgiving. The folks who were standing with Stevenson. Yeah. Somehow Martin managed to ride all of that out, though.
He did. It's pretty amazing when you think about it, particularly the infighting between the Stevenson supporters and the Kennedy supporters. But Martin had gotten to know both of the Kennedy brothers, Robert and John, by covering the Rackets Committee and their case against Jimmy Hoffa, and had written a very non-biased, well-received series on the whole Rackets investigation. And Robert Kennedy had become very impressed with Martin at that time period and even asked him, after his stories had already appeared and some time had passed, if he might want to write for his brother, who was running for the 1916 nomination. But Martin put him and his brother off, saying, that he would like to, but until Stevenson made his final decision, he could not commit to that. And the Kennedys did respect that kind of loyalty. And so afterwards, when Stevenson didn't really make a big effort for the nomination and John Kennedy won, they came to him and he joined the Kennedy speechwriting staff for the 1916 presidential campaign.
And out of that became eventually ambassador to the Dominican Republic, right? So it's
That's right.
A third career. And, what was his relationship? Obviously, there was a close relationship with Stevenson. What was the relationship like with JFK?
It was very close. After John Kennedy had been assassinated, Martin observed that for every person, there's one president that's kind of your president.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big influence on your life. And for his father, it had been FDR. And for him, it was John Kennedy.
If you are just joining us, we're talking with Ray Boomhauer about his new book about John Bartlow Martin. This is a recorded show. We're not taking calls. We're not taking emails, Facebook messages, or tweets. But we do hope you're enjoying the conversation. You are listening to No Limits. I am John Kroll. Please stay with us.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking in this special recorded No Limits with historian Ray Boomhauer about his new book on John Bartlow Martin, sort of one of the 20th century's leading man of letters, who was a Hoosier. The new book is John Bartlow Martin, A Voice for the Underdog. This is a recorded show, so we're not taking calls, emails, Facebook messages, or tweets. We've talked about really the evolution of Martin's career up to this point, kind of left him as being a confidant of John F. Kennedy's and an ambassador to the Dominican Republic. I feel like I'd be remiss, though, if we didn't talk a little bit, because he's not a figure that, he worked with Arthur Schlesinger Jr., but Schlesinger's work is still read and remembered, and Martin's less so. So he's a figure at some level who needed to be, pulled back into the spotlight. And I'd like to talk with you a little bit about what motivated you to want to do that. What drew you to wanting to tell Martin's story?
Well, I've always, whenever I've written a number of biographies of famous Hoosiers, I try to follow the dictates of David McCullough, who once gave a talk here in Indianapolis that was brought here by the Indiana Historical Society, the organization I work for. And he mentioned that before he started his Truman biography, he had been engaged in one on Pablo Picasso. But as he got more and more into researching his life, realized he couldn't stand Pablo Picasso. So I decided life's too short and got out of that and advised any kind of writer, if you're going to tackle a project like a biography, which can take years, often even sometimes decades for some writers, I don't ever take that long, you're going to have to enjoy spending time with the person. And John Bartlow Martin is someone I've been involved with for a long time. When I first started to work at the Indiana Historical Society back in 1987, I wanted to know more about Indiana history because I hadn't had it since fourth grade. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to, be up on Indiana and what it meant. And I turned to Martin's book, Indiana Interpretation, and I was blown away by the way that he punctured the myth of being a Hoosier and had a very clear-eyed view of the state. And some of the seamier aspects of it, as well as some of the
It wasn't all ain't
noble
got
aspect.
Good in Indiana.
No, that's right, exactly. And so I got very interested in his career, did an article on him for Traces Magazine, the magazine of the Indiana Historical Society. I was on the board of the Indiana Journalism Hall of Fame and was on it when he was inducted in 1999, and I always wanted to write his biography. And just kept on, piling up the research year after year, and finally sat down and wrote the book that came out from Indiana University Press just recently.
Yeah, just like a week and a half
That's
ago, right?
Yeah.
What, what accounts for the fact that, as I say, a lot of the other, leading lights from that period still have a significant audience? Why do you think that Martin slipped into some obscurity?
I think it's because the periodicals that he wrote for at the time, Saturday Evening Post in particular, are no longer really around like they were, or no longer as important as they were. They were supplanted by television in the late 1950s, early 1960s. And so his work sometimes is forgotten. He didn't write a major book except for the Adlai Stevenson biography, and Adlai Stevenson is a two-time loser in presidential contests, mm-hmm. so he's remembered for his work with Adlai Stevenson and his work on his biography, which is, the biography of Adlai Stevenson. And so I think that's why his work is forgotten. But if you're someone who's involved in journalism, and particularly if you were a journalist mm-hmm. during that time period, you knew the name John Bartlow Martin. In fact, one of his friends said that if you were a writer at that time, you tried not to read a lot of his writing because you find yourself being influenced by it and starting to write like Martin did. Mm-hmm. So, unfortunately, his name has been lost in history, and I hope by this biography that his name will be out in front again. And some of the lesser-known aspects of his career, including his very close ties to Newton Minow and the Vast Wasteland speech, mm-hmm. which is still remembered today when he was the FCC chairman in John Kennedy's administration. You know, John Bartlow Martin had a lot to do with that speech. He helped Minow with it and came up with that phrase.
Oh, in some ways, reading your book, what I was struck with is, okay, John Bartlow Martin must have been the inspiration for Woody Allen Zelig. I mean, he seems to show up at mm-hmm. every historically significant moment. He has some role there or some perch of observation that he can use to record the experience. And I guess what things surprised you in researching his life?
I think the thing that surprised me is his adaptability. His ability to go from Adlai Stevenson to the Kennedy brothers, to Lyndon Johnson, to Hubert Humphrey. All these are Democrats, of course, but they're quite different personalities. They're quite different to work for. And as you brought up earlier, there's this great schism between the Stevensonian Democrats and the Kennedy Democrats, and yet Martin bridged that gap. And there was something about him that he was able to not take things too personal. As he said later on in life, after 20 years of writing for speeches for presidential mm-hmm. candidates, he didn't take himself that seriously. If his stuff didn't get used, fine. He wasn't going to quit the campaign and write a tell-all book about the inside story of what went wrong with this candidacy. He was a professional, and the candidates knew they could trust him to keep their secrets.
What was his obviously he got people to embrace him. I mean, among other things, what I noticed was in reading your book was a pattern of really being able to find patrons, mentors, Frederick Lewis Allen at Harper's, and to some degree all of the political stuff. What was his gift for the nature of his gift for developing and kind of nurturing those relationships? Because he doesn't strike me in reading the book as a backslapper or a hail fellow well met kind of jovial life of the party guy.
I think it goes back to how he viewed his career. I don't think, considered himself as a natural born writer. He considered himself someone like a carpenter who worked at it and honed his craft by doing it again and again. And I think this dedication to his profession impressed everyone he worked with. Plus, he did his job, he did it well, and he did it fast. It reminds me of the old A.J. Liebling quote, I can write better than anyone who can write faster and can write faster than anyone who can write better. And Martin was someone like that. They knew that he could churn out copy at great speed, and it would be fine prose as well.
In terms of telling his story, what was the hardest thing to do?
The hardest part for me was dealing with his time as ambassador to the Dominican Republic, because that's not an area of my expertise. I don't know a lot about that region. I don't speak Spanish. So it was hard for me to really know the background of that period of his life. So I had to do a lot of reading. It was a very important aspect of his life, and I tried to treat it as best as I could. But I wish I knew more about that region going into writing the book. I did learn more about it. And Martin was one of those diplomats who really tried to make a difference in the country that he was in. It was a very fragile time in Dominican politics. They had, finally had a democratic election after years under a dictatorship. But unfortunately, it all went tragically wrong. There was a coup. The democratically elected president, Juan Bosch, was ousted, and Martin was recalled back home. So it was quite a depressing time for him.
And in terms of the reporting of that, what was the most fun part? I mean, the part that you really enjoyed?
I think the most fun part, because of my interest in politics, were the presidential campaigns.
Because you'd visited that, one of them, earlier, right?
Robert Kennedy's campaign here in Indiana, which John Bartlow Martin had a big role in at that time, because he knew the state and felt himself a key advisor to Kennedy in helping him win the primary at that time in 1968. So I knew that part of his story very well. I also really enjoyed his days as an early freelance writer in Chicago, just the vitality of the city at that time. When he was writing for the Fact Detective magazines, very involved with Chicago's police criminal class. And it was an exciting time in his life and an exciting time to write about.
Well, and that's one of the things I really enjoyed about your book. You make that period of time when magazines really were a dominant force mm-hmm. come alive. And for those of us who've loved magazines and realize the struggles they encounter right now, mm-hmm. it's fun to realize that there was actually a time when journalists were almost celebrities working there. So,
also a fun time to be a freelance writer.
Oh, yeah.
I loved his writing about taking the train from Chicago to New York to talk to magazine editors about future projects and what an exciting trip that was for him, staying at the Algonquin Hotel in New York City and meeting with these editors. The thrill of that must have been something for a writer at that time.
How did he sort of cope with I'm going to ask another question here real quickly because it occurred to me, did the sort of irony of him, because it sounds like he was considered the resident expert for a lot of years on Indiana, even though, as far as I can tell, he never lived here after for the last 45 years of his life.
It's kind of ironic, but he knew the state very well. His parents still lived here in Indianapolis, and he made their home his base during the 1968 campaign. So there were a lot of visits back and forth. He didn't live here, but he had family in the state, so there were a lot of visits. And just Indiana was a major influence on his life. That childhood growing up, influenced his subsequent career. And so I think at the time he wrote Indiana in Interpretation, he thought that because his childhood was dark that he wouldn't like writing a book. But he found himself thinking that he really enjoyed doing that. And he thought there was a certain amount of affection in the portrait that he did in the book of this state. Now, a lot of people in the state at the time didn't see that affection and felt that he had been perhaps too harsh in his interpretation. But after all, it was his interpretation of Indiana. And so it's kind of compelling that his voice is out there giving his own view of the state and really causing people to think twice about what Indiana means.
Yeah, and almost 70 years after it was published, the book's still in print.
Still in print, and people still read
consulted,
it.
Yeah.
And you really get a sense of the Indiana character by reading it.
Well, how did he deal with sort of the arrival of new journalism? I mean, by the time he comes back from being ambassador to the Dominican Republic, that whole magazine world that he'd kind of dominated was going through a revolution of itself, with a lot of the Tom Wolfe's, Gay Talese's, what Willie Morris was doing at Harper's Magazine. How did he deal with that change in the world?
Well, when he returned later in his life for a decade, he taught courses at the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University. And if you read his memoirs, you get the feeling that they weren't happy days for him. He didn't like the direction that journalism was going. He always followed the dictates of E.B. White, as a writer. Put yourself in the background. Mm-hmm. The story is the main thing. And he never put himself in his stories, which is quite unlike the way that Tom Wolfe and Hunter Thompson, the other new journalists, were doing at that time. But in talking to the students who took his advanced writing course at Northwestern, he was very serious about what he was doing and had a big influence on his students, more so than he lets on in his memoirs. He would take promising students, invite them to his home in Highland Park, and go over their stories line by line by line, trying to improve them and make them better writers as much as he could. And as Greg Easterbrook, one of his students, said at Northwestern, he didn't suffer fools gladly. And so if he was going to call you in to discuss your writing, you paid attention to what he was saying.
And you listened to him. In terms of you know, his dismay sort of about the direction of journalism, you know, was he able to continue, you know, working at the level he had worked at earlier, or did some of the markets he had exploited before been able to use?
Those markets had dried up, but he found new ways to do his writing. He wrote a lot of reviews for newspapers, including the Chicago Tribune. For a time, he had a column in Life magazine until that died away, unfortunately. And so there were outlets for his writing, not as much as he would like to. He even turned to fiction for a time. Wrote a book called The Televised of Heller that kind of put together all the experience he had in political campaigns during his lifetime. He put it in one book and kind of wrote himself out after a time. Tried some other fiction projects, but none ever really saw the light of day. But I think it all came together when he wrote his memoir, and that occupied a lot of his final years until his death in 1987. From cancer. He'd been a lifelong smoker, so
throat
they finally
cancer,
caught up with him.
Yeah,
it's 2.5 pack of cigarettes a day. We'll do that to you.
Yes, it will. Yes, it will. So, as you mentioned earlier, you've done now a series of sort of portraits of either significant Indiana historical figures or moments in the state's history. What's next for you?
Well, I'm kind of going away from Indiana for my next project. I'm looking at another journalist, a gentleman named Robert Sherrod, who wrote for Time and Life magazines and was their Pacific correspondent during World War II. So I'm looking at his writings from that era. He was, as I tell people who say, who's Robert Sherrod? Well, he was what Ernie Pyle was for the GI in Europe and North Africa. Sherrod was for the U.S. Marine Corps and their campaigns in the Pacific. So
he just did not have get the press that
did not get the press that
Pyle did. So, in terms of this book, John Bartlow Martin, A Voice for the Underdog, what do you hope the takeaway will be for readers? Do you want to drive them back to his books?
I'd like to drive them back to his books, including his regional history of the Upper Peninsula. They call it North Country, which is still one of the better regional histories that you'll come across. Indiana and interpretation, and particularly his memoir, It Seems Like Only Yesterday, as well as his two-volume massive book on Adlai Stevenson. There's a lot to be learned about Stevenson by looking at Martin's work.
Well, I think that will be a good last word. I'd like to thank my guest, Ray Boomhour. Ray, thank you for talking with us today.
Glad to be here, John. Thank you.
And we will be back on Thursday when we're going to celebrate National Poetry Month by listening to the work of poets. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.